Where do gods come from? Where do they go? Some attempt to answer this was made by the religious philosopher Kumi of Smail in his book Ego Video Liber Deorum, which translates into the vernacular roughly as gods, a spotter's guide. People said there had to be a supreme being, because otherwise how could the universe exist, eh? And of course there clearly had to be, said Kumi, a supreme being. But since the universe was a bit of a mess, it was obvious that the supreme being hadn't in fact made it. If he had made it, he would, being supreme, have made a much better job of it, with far better thought given, taking an example at random, to things like the design of the common nostril. Or to put it another way, the existence of a badly put together watch proved the existence of a blind watchmaker. You had only to look around to see that there was room for improvement practically everywhere. This suggested that the universe had probably been put together in a bit of a rush by an underling while a supreme being wasn't looking, in the same way that Boy Scouts Association minutes are done on office photocopiers all over the country. So, reasoned Kumi, it was not a good idea to address any prayers to a supreme being. It would only attract his attention and might cause trouble. And yet, there seemed to be a lot of lesser gods around the place. Kumi's theory was that gods come into being and grow and flourish because they are believed in. Belief itself is the food of the gods. Initially, when mankind lived in small primitive tribes, there were probably millions of gods. Now there tended to be only a very few important ones. Local gods of thunder and love, for example, tended to run together like pools of mercury as the small primitive tribes joined up and became huge, powerful primitive tribes with more sophisticated weapons. But any god could join. Any god could start small. Any god could grow in stature as its believers increased, and dwindle as they decreased. It was like a great big game of ladders and snakes. Gods liked games, provided they were winning. Kumi's theory was largely based on the good old Gnostic heresy, which tends to turn up all over the multiverse when men get up off their knees and start thinking for 2 minutes together, although the shock of the sudden altitude tends to mean the thinking is a little whacked. But it upsets priests, who tend to vent their displeasure in traditional ways. When the Omnian Church found out about Kumi, they displayed him in every town within the church's empire to demonstrate the essential flaws in his argument. There were a lot of towns, so they had to cut him up quite small. Ragged clouds ripped across the skies. The sails creaked in the rising wind, and Om could hear the shouts of the sailors as they tried to outrun the storm. It was going to be a big storm, even by the mariners' standards. White water crowned the waves. Brother snored in his nest. Om listened to the sailors. They were not men who dealt in sophistries. Someone had killed a porpoise, and everyone knew what that meant. It meant that there was going to be a storm. It meant that the ship was going to be sunk. It was simple cause and effect. It was worse than women aboard. It was worse than albatrosses. Om wondered if tortoises could swim. Turtles could, he was pretty sure, but those buggers had the shell for it. It would be too much to ask, even if a god had anyone to ask, that a body designed for trundling around a dry wilderness had any hydrodynamic properties other than those necessary to sink to the bottom. Oh well, nothing else for it. He was still a god. He had rights. He slid down a coil of rope and crawled carefully to the edge of the swaying deck, wedging his shell against a stanchion so that he could see down into the roiling water. Then he spoke in a voice audible to nothing that was mortal. Nothing happened for a while. Then one wave rose higher than the rest and changed shape as it rose. Water poured upward, filling an invisible mould. It was humanoid, but obviously only because it wanted to be. It could as easily have been a waterspout, or an undertow. The sea is always powerful. So many people believe in it. But it seldom answers prayers. The water shape rose level with the deck and kept pace with Om. It developed a face and opened a mouth.
"Well," it said.
"Greetings, O Queen of..."
Om began. The watery eyes focused.
"But you are just a small god, and you dare to summon me?"
The wind howled in the rigging.
"I have believers," said Om, "so I have the right."
There was the briefest of pauses. Then the Sea Queen said,
"One believer."
"One or many does not matter here," said Om. "I have rights."
"And what rights do you demand, little tortoise?" said the Queen of the Sea.
"Save the ship," said Om.
The Queen was silent.
"You have to grant the request," said Om. "It's the rules."
"But I can name my price," said the Sea Queen.
"That's the rules too."
"And it will be high."
"It will be paid."
The column of water began to collapse back into the waves.
"I will consider this."
Om stared down into the white sea. The ship rolled, sliding him back down the deck, and then rolled back. A flailing foreclaw hooked itself around the stanchion as Om's shell spun around, and for a moment both hind legs paddled helplessly over the waters. And then Om was shaken free. Something white swept down towards him as he seesawed over the edge, and he bit it. Brother yelled and pulled his hand up, with Om trailing on the end of it.
"You didn't have to bite!"
The ship pitched into a wave and flung him onto the deck. Om let go and rolled away. When Brother got to his feet, or at least to his hands and knees, he saw the crewmen standing around him. Two of them grabbed him by the elbows as a wave crashed over the ship.
"What are you doing?"
They were trying to avoid looking at his face. They dragged him towards the rail. Somewhere in the scuppers, Om screamed at the Sea Queen.
"It's the rules! The rules!"
Four sailors had got hold of Brother now. Om could hear, above the roaring of the storm, the silence of the desert.
"Wait!"
said Brother.
"It's nothing personal," said one of the sailors. "We don't want to do this."
"I don't want you to do it either," said Brother. "Is that any help?"
"The sea wants a life," said the oldest sailor. "Yours is nearest. Okay, get his..."
"Can I make peace with my God?"
"What?"
"If you're going to kill me, can I pray to my God first?"
"It's not us that's killing you," said the sailor. "It's the sea."
"The hand that does the deed is guilty of the crime," said Brother. "Ossory, chapter 56, verse 93.
The sailors looked at one another. At a time like this, it was probably not wise to antagonize any god. The ship skidded down the side of a wave.
"You've got 10 seconds, said the oldest sailor. "That's 10 seconds more than many men get."
Brother lay down on the deck, helped considerably by another wave that slammed into the timbers. Om was dimly aware of the prayer, to his surprise. He couldn't make out the words, but the prayer itself was an itch at the back of his mind.
"Don't ask me," he said, trying to get upright. "I'm out of options."
The ship smacked down onto a calm sea. The storm still raged, but only around a widening circle with the ship in the middle. The lightning, stabbing at the sea, surrounded them like the bars of a cage. The circle lengthened ahead of them. Now the ship sped down a narrow channel of calm between grey walls of storm a mile high. Electric fire raged overhead and then was gone. Behind them, a mountain of greyness squatted on the sea. They could hear the thunder dying away. Brother got uncertainly to his feet, swaying wildly to compensate for a motion that was no longer there.
"Now I..." he began.
He was alone. The sailors had fled.
"Om?"
said Brother.
"Over here."
Brother fished his god out of the seaweed.
"You said you couldn't do anything," he said accusingly.
"That wasn't me."
Om paused. "There will be a price," he thought. "It won't be cheap. It can't be cheap. The Sea Queen is a god. I've crushed a few towns in my time. Holy fire, that kind of thing. If the price isn't high, how can people respect you?"
"I made arrangements," he said.
Tidal waves, a ship sunk, a couple of towns disappearing under the sea. It'll be something like that. If people don't respect, then they won't fear, and if they don't fear, how can you get them to believe? Seems unfair, really. One man killed a porpoise. Of course, it doesn't matter to the Queen who gets thrown overboard, just as it didn't matter to him which porpoise he killed. And that's unfair, because it was Vorbis who did it. He makes people do things they shouldn't do. What am I thinking about? Before I was a tortoise, I didn't even know what unfair meant. The hatches opened. People came on deck and hung on the rail. Being on deck in stormy weather always has the possibility of being washed overboard, but that takes on a rosy glow after hours below decks with frightened horses and seasick passengers. There were no more storms. The ship ploughed on in favourable winds under a clear sky in a sea as empty of life as the hot desert. The days passed uneventfully. Vorbis stayed below decks for most of the time. The crew treated Brother with cautious respect. News like Brother spreads quickly. The coast here was dunes with the occasional barren salt marsh. A heat haze hung over the land. It was the kind of coast where shipwrecked landfall is more to be dreaded than drowning. There were no seabirds. Even the birds that had been trailing the ship for scraps had vanished. "No eagles," said Om. There was that to be said about it. Towards the evening of the fourth day, the unedifying panorama was punctuated by a glitter of light high on the dune sea. It flashed with a sort of rhythm. The captain, whose face now looked as if sleep had not been a regular night-time companion, called Brother over.
"Is your... the deacon told me to watch out for this," he said. "You go fetch him now."
Vorbis had a cabin somewhere near the bilges, where the air was as thick as thin soup. Brother knocked.
"Enter?"
Words are the litmus paper of the mind. If you find yourself in the power of someone who will use the word commence in cold blood, go somewhere else very quickly. But if they say enter, don't stop to pack. There were no portholes down here. Vorbis was sitting in the dark.
"Yes, brother."
"The captain sent me to fetch you, lord. Something's shining in the desert."
"Good. Now, brother, attend. The captain has a mirror. You will ask to borrow it?"
What is a mirror, lord?"
"An unholy and forbidden device," said Vorbis, "which regretfully can be pressed into godly service. He will deny it, of course, but a man with such a neat beard and tiny moustache is vain, and a vain man must have his mirror, so take it. And stand in the sun and move the mirror so that it shines the sun towards the desert. Do you understand?"
"No, lord."
"Your ignorance is your protection, my son. And then come back and tell me what you see."
Om dozed in the sun. Brother had found him a little space near the pointy end where he could get sun with little danger of being seen by the crew, and the crew were jittery enough at the moment not to go looking for trouble in any case. A tortoise dreams for millions of years. It was the dream time, the unformed time. The small gods chittered and whirred in the wilderness places, and the cold places, and the deep places. They swarmed in the darkness without memory, but driven by hope and lust for one thing. The one thing a god craves, belief. There are no medium-sized trees in the deep forest. There are only the towering ones whose canopy spreads across the sky. Below, in the gloom, there's light for nothing but mosses and ferns. But when a giant falls, leaving a little space, then there's a race between the trees on either side who want to spread out, and the seedlings below who race to grow up. Sometimes you can make your own space. Forests were a very long way from the wilderness. The nameless voice that was going to be Om drifted on the wind on the edge of the desert, trying to be heard among countless others, trying to avoid being pushed into the centre. It may have whirled for millions of years. It had nothing with which to measure time. All it had was hope, and a certain sense of the presence of things, and a voice. And there was a day, in a sense, it was the first day. Om had been aware of the shepherd for some time, for a while. The flock had been wandering closer and closer. The rains had been sparse, forage was scarce, hungry mouths propelled hungry legs further into the rocks, searching out the hitherto scorned clumps of sun-seared grass. They were sheep, possibly the most stupid animal in the universe, with the possible exception of the duck, but even their uncomplicated minds couldn't hear the voice because sheep don't listen. There was a lamb, though. It had strayed a little way. Om saw to it that it strayed a little further, around a rock, down the slope, into the crevice. Its bleating drew the mother. The crevice was well hidden, and the ewe was, after all, content now that she had her lamb. She saw no reason to bleat, even when the shepherd wandered about the rocks calling, cursing, and eventually pleading. The shepherd had 100 sheep, and it might have been surprising that he was prepared to spend days searching for one sheep. In fact, it was because he was the kind of man prepared to spend days looking for a lost sheep that he had 100 sheep. The voice that was going to be Om waited. It was on the evening of the second day that he scared up a partridge that had been nesting near the crevice just as the shepherd was wandering by. It wasn't much of a miracle, but it was good enough for the shepherd. He made a cairn of stones at the spot, and next day brought his whole flock into the area, and in the heat of the afternoon he lay down to sleep, and Om spoke to him, inside his head. 3 weeks later, the shepherd was stoned to death by the priests of Ur-Gilash, who was at that time the chief god in the area. But they were too late. Om already had 100 believers, and the number was growing. Only a mile away from the shepherd and his flock was a goat herd and his herd. The merest accident of microgeography had meant that the first man to hear the voice of Om, and who gave Om his view of humans, was a shepherd and not a goat herd. They have quite different ways of looking at the world, and the whole of history might have been different. For sheep are stupid and have to be driven, but goats are intelligent and need to be led. Ur-Gilash, thought Om. Ah, those were the days. When Ossory and his followers had broken into the temple and smashed the altar and had thrown the priestesses out of the window to be torn apart by wild dogs, which was the correct way of doing things, and there had been a mighty wailing and gnashing of feet, and the followers of Om had lit their campfires in the crumbled halls of Gilash, just as the prophet had said, and that counted, even though he'd said it only 5 minutes earlier. When they were only looking for the firewood, because everyone agreed a prophecy is a prophecy, and no one said you had to wait a long time for it to come true. Great days, great days. Every day fresh converts. The rise of Om had been unstoppable. He jerked awake. Old Ur-Gilash. Weather god, wasn't he? Yes, no. Maybe one of your basic giant spider gods, something like that. Whatever happened to him? What happened to me? How does it happen? You hang around the astral planes, going with the flow, enjoy the rhythms of the universe. You think that all the, you know, humans are getting on with the believing back down there. You decide to go and stir them up a bit, and then the tortoise. It's like going to the bank and finding the money's been leaking out through a hole. The first you know is when you stroll down looking for a handy mind, and suddenly you're a tortoise and there's no power left to get out. 3 years of looking up at practically everything. Old Ur-Gilash. Perhaps he was hanging on as a lizard somewhere, with some old hermit as his only believer. More likely he had been blown out into the desert. A small god was lucky to get one chance. There was something wrong. Om couldn't quite put his finger on it, and not only because he didn't have a finger. Gods rose and fell like bits of onion in a boiling soup. But this time was different. There was something wrong this time. He'd forced out Ur-Gilash, fair enough, law of the jungle. But no one was challenging him. Where was Brother?
Brother!
Brother was counting the flashes of light off the desert.
It's a good thing I had a mirror, yes, said the captain, hopefully. I expect his lordship won't mind about the mirror, because it turned out to be useful.
I don't think he thinks like that, said Brother, still counting.
No, I don't think he does either, said the captain gloomily.
7, and then 4.
It'll be the quisition for me, said the captain.
Brother was about to say, then rejoice that your soul shall be purified, but he didn't. And he didn't know why he didn't. I'm sorry about that, he said. A veneer of surprise overlaid the captain's grief.
You people usually say something about how the quisition is good for the soul, he said.
I'm sure it is, said Brother.
The captain was watching his face intently.
It's flat, you know, he said quietly. I've sailed out into the rim ocean. It's flat, and I've seen the edge, and it moves. Not the edge, I mean. What's down there? They can cut my head off, but it will still move.
But it will stop moving for you, said Brother, so I should be careful to whom you speak, Captain.
The captain leaned closer.
The turtle moves,
he hissed and darted away.
Brother?
Guilt jerked Brother upright like a hooked fish. He turned around and sagged with relief. It wasn't Vorbis, it was only God. He padded over to the place in front of the mast. Om glared up at him.
Yes, said Brother.
You never come and see me, said the tortoise. I know you're busy, it added sarcastically, but a quick prayer would be nice, even.
I checked you first thing this morning, said Brother.
And I'm hungry.
You had a whole melon rind last night.
And who had the melon, eh? No, he didn't, said Brother. He eats stale bread and water. Why doesn't he eat fresh bread? He waits for it to get stale. Yes, I expect he does, said the tortoise.
Om?
What?
The captain just said something odd. He said the world is flat and has an edge.
Yes, so what?
But, I mean, we know the world is a ball because... The tortoise blinked.
No, it's not, he said. Who said it's a ball?
You did, said Brother. Then he added, according to Book One of the Septuagint, anyway. I've never thought like this before, he thought. I'd never have said, anyway.
Why'd the captain tell me something like that, he said. It's not normal conversation.
I told you, I never made the world, said Om. Why should I make the world? It was here already. And if I did make a world, I wouldn't make it a ball. People'd fall off. All the seed ran off the bottom.
Not if you told it to stay on.
Heh! Will you hark at the man?
Besides, the sphere is a perfect shape, said Brother, because in the book of...
Nothing amazing about a sphere, said the tortoise. Come to that, a turtle is a perfect shape.
A perfect shape for what?
Well, a perfect shape for a turtle, to start with, said Om. If it was shaped like a ball, it'd be bobbing to the surface the whole time.
But it's a heresy to say the world is flat, said Brother.
Maybe, but it's true.
And it's really on the back of a giant turtle?
That's right.
Oh, in that case, said Brother triumphantly, what does the turtle stand on?
The tortoise gave him a blank stare.
It doesn't stand on anything, it said. It's a turtle, for heaven's sake. It swims. That's what turtles are for.
I think I'd better go and report to Vorbis, said Brother. He goes very calm if he's kept waiting. What did you want me for? I'll try and bring you some more food after supper.
How are you feeling? Said the tortoise.
I'm feeling all right, thank you.
Eating properly? That sort of thing?
Yes, thank you.
Pleased to hear it. Run along now. I mean, I'm only your god.
Om raised its voice as Brother hurried off.
And you might visit more often. And pray louder. I'm fed up with straining, he shouted.
Vorbis was still sitting in his cabin when Brother puffed along the passage and knocked on the door. There was no reply. After a while, Brother pushed the door open. Vorbis did not appear to read. Obviously he wrote because of the famous letters, but no one ever saw him do it. When he was alone, he spent a lot of time staring at the wall or prostrate in prayer. Vorbis could humble himself in prayer in a way that made the posturings of power-mad emperors look subservient. Said Brother, and tried to pull the door shut again. Vorbis waved one hand irritably, then he stood up. He did not dust off his robe.
"Do you know, Brother," he said, "I do not think there is a single person in the citadel who would dare to interrupt me at prayer. They would fear the Quisition. Everyone fears the Quisition, except you, it appears. Do you fear the Quisition?"
Brother looked into the black-on-black eyes. Vorbis looked into a round pink face. There was a special face that people wore when they spoke to an Exquisitor. It was flat and expressionless, and glistened slightly, and even a half-trained Exquisitor could read the barely concealed guilt like a book. Brother just looked out of breath, but then he always did. It was fascinating.
"No, Lord," he said.
"Why not?"
"The Quisition protects us, Lord. It is written in Ossory, chapter 7, verse..."
Vorbis put his head on one side.
"Of course it is. But have you ever thought that the Quisition could be wrong?"
"No, Lord," said Brother.
"But why not?"
"I do not know why, Lord Vorbis, I just never have."
Vorbis sat down at a little writing table, no more than a board that folded down from the hull.
"And you are right, Brother," he said, "because the Quisition cannot be wrong. Things can only be as the god wishes them. It is impossible to think that the world could run in any other way. Is this not so?
A vision of a one-eyed tortoise flickered momentarily in Brother's mind. Brother had never been any good at lying. The truth itself had always seemed so incomprehensible that complicating things even further had always been beyond him.
"So the Septuke teaches us," he said.
"Where there is punishment, there is always a crime," said Vorbis. "Sometimes the crime follows the punishment which only serves to prove the foresight of the great god."
"That's what my grandmother used to say," said Brother, automatically.
"Indeed. I would like to know more about this formidable lady."
"She used to give me a thrashing every morning, because I would certainly do something to deserve it during the day," said Brother.
"A most complete understanding of the nature of mankind," said Vorbis, with his chin on one hand. "Were it not for the deficiency of her sex, it sounds as though she would have made an excellent inquisitor."
Brother nodded. "Oh, yes, yes, indeed."
"And now," said Vorbis, with no change in his tone, "you will tell me what you saw in the desert."
There were 6 flashes, and then a pause of about 5 heartbeats, and then 8 flashes, and another pause, and 2 flashes."
Vorbis nodded thoughtfully.
3/4, he said.
"All praise to the great God. He is my staff and guide through the hard places.
And you may go."
Brother hadn't expected to be told what the flashes meant and wasn't going to inquire. The Quisition asked the questions. They were known for it.